Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 236th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 235 shows can be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. In our last show, way back on May 20th, I said that I would return on June 17th, refreshed and ready to go for another year. Well, I am refreshed and ready to go for another year, but June 17th, Father's Day, got in the way of a return last week. The show needs both the guests and the audience to be successful, and I didn't see either available on June 17th. Next week, July 1st, my guests will be writer, space enthusiast, ex-IBM executive and member of the Mayapak Writers Group, short story writer Bob Lee. I hope that you'll be with us then and every Sunday for this year's season. Before going any further, a few announcements. I was the featured speaker yesterday at an Iona College on International Business, Economics, Education, and Environment, but that's a long conference, in which I spoke about personal artificial intelligence in the home office, demonstrating on an Amazon Alexa. I'm in the process of revisiting the PowerPoint to support the presentation so that it may be more robust to those who did not get to the presentation but asked for material. So I'm reviving it now. If there's any lesson to wish is a copy, please email me at johnmack13@gmail.com and ask for one. And once again, as stated above, John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. I will be the featured poet on Tuesday, June 26th at 7 p.m. at the legendary Curly's Diner in Stamford, Connecticut, 602 Park Place in Stamford. My reading will be followed by an open mic. Wednesday, June 17th, will be the monthly meeting of the Yorktown Poetry Workshop at 6 p.m. at the John C. Hart Memorial Library, and that's at 1130 Main Street, Shrub Oak, New York. If you plan to read, please come, even if you don't, please bring 10 extra copies of your poem. Thursday, June 28th, will be the regular weekly meeting of the Mayapak Writers Group at 6:15 p.m. at the Mayapak Library, which is at 668 Route 6, Mayapak, New York. Join us whether you wish to read or just listen. And now to this week's guest, as mentioned, my 236th in the series. My guest is author, poet, television technician, and member of the aforementioned Mayapak Writers Group, Jeffrey Edrich. Listeners wishing to join Jeff and me on the air may do so by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold caller participation until the end of my conversation with my guest. I met Jeff a number of years ago when I joined the now 21-year-old Mayor Pack Writers Group. The group meets weekly and is composed of published and fledgling authors, journalists, and poets under the coordination of Vinny Tenko, a published author and a two-time guest on this show. Jeff is the veteran of this group and has long impressed me both with his own writing and his thoughtful criticism of the work of others. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks. Great to be here.
But where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and early school was in Riverdale, and that's it, pretty simply.
I lived in Riverdale for a good while, but my children went to PS 24. I believe you went to 83. From your writing to me, you had a lot of trauma after PS 83. Are you comfortable talking about it?
Yeah, sure. The funny thing is it didn't seem like trauma. It just seemed like, oh, that's what happens. So basically, I was coming out of school with my friend, and my brother was in a car, called my name, you know, hey, Jeff. And I usually walked home by school with my friend Steve every day. Just, you know, we walked home. So I thought, why is my brother calling me, and what's he doing in that car? And I don't know who's the guy in the front seat of that car. And, oh, my mom's in there, too. Wow, what's going on? And then my brother called out as I was walking down the steps, like, happy, like, Jeffrey, we're going to Florida. And I got in the car, and this man who later became my stepfather drove us to Florida. And I thought, oh, I guess it's okay because my mom's here and she's happy and my brother seemed happy. He was like 4. I was 7. And, you know, that was the beginning of, a life with a stepfather.
How long were you in Florida?
We drove down there like straight and there for a month. My mom enrolled me in the schools, and I loved it down there. I just thought, I don't know what just happened, but this is great. There's palm trees. My stepfather seemed nice at the time, so I thought, okay, maybe this is what happens, when you're 7. And I just loved the warm weather because it had been icy cold and freezing and bitter in New York. So I thought this was like a dream come true. And then after about a month there, we drove back, and my brother and I were just little kids. We didn't want to go. We were like, we don't want to go home. And, you know, my mom was like, well, don't you want to see your father? And we're like, well, yeah. So anyway, we went back home, and we got home right around the holidays, right around Christmas. It was perfect, like white snow falling. And we went back to our old apartment, and I said to Tom, who was, you know, fatherly, I said, why aren't you coming up? And he said, oh, no, that's okay. I'll stay in the car. So we went up to our apartment, my mom, my brother, myself, and opened the door, and there was my dad, of course. And we hugged him and then kind of realized, my God, this is our real dad. And he had bought a whole bedroom full of toys for us. So my brother and I raced into the bedroom, played with the toys all afternoon. And then my dad called us out and said, hey, I got to go. I'll see you guys soon. And my brother and I were like, what do you mean? You live here. where are you going? You know, we just figured, okay, everything's back to normal, you know. And he said, no, that's okay. I'll see you guys later. And he smiled at us and closed the door, and we kind of stared at each other, at my mom, and just kind of figured, okay, I guess this is normal too, you know? So that was the start of that.
And then you wound up moving from Riverdale, didn't you?
Yeah, we moved out to Matawan, New Jersey. And that was nice because our stepfather had more money, so he bought a nice house, and, you know, we had two cars. You know, we were a typical suburban family with my real dad. You know, we lived in an apartment. He had a car for a little while, but got in an accident, and he never bought another one. So this, you know, made my mom happier, and it seemed like, oh, this is kind of nice. But he was really a strict guy. You know, he used to just smack us at the dinner table so routinely that we were just used to it. Just, you know, we didn't eat right with a fork, a knife, we didn't say the right thing. So when our cousin came over, everybody who sat at our table would eventually end up getting smacked over dinner. It was like normal. So our cousin got smacked and started crying. My brother and I looked at each other and kind of quietly were like, wow, what a baby. You know, because we had just gotten used to it. But anyway, there was a lot of unhappiness. You know, I didn't like living at home. And when I finished my junior year in high school, I'd been bugging my parents for my stepfather and my mom. I said, I want to leave. I want to get out of here. And they kept saying, as long as you're under 18, you know, you have to stay here. And when you're 18, you can do whatever you want. But I bugged the crap out of them. And one day they just said, my stepfather said, okay, you can go. And within 2 weeks, I was at the airport. They took me to the airport. And my stepfather's daughter, who was an adult, met me on the other side of the country in Los Angeles. She picked me up, and she got me in a really nice boarding house. And I started my life over there as a 17-year-old, you know, just trying to make some decisions about how to go forward.
You said in your note to me that you were happy living there in this rented room, swimming in the pool, watching an infant, finishing high school, learning the trade, and working, making video and audio tapes. Yet your neighbor in the house saw you as lonely, and you concur. How could you be both happy and be lonely at the same time?
Because I was, like, elated to be on my own and away from my stepfather. I mean, it was just like I was just elated. I was on my own, and I went shopping for the first time by myself at Vaughn's supermarket, you know, with my denim jacket and jeans, you know, 17-year-old kid with long, pushing a shopping cart, like, for the first time. What do I buy for myself, you know, peanut butter, jelly bread, some milk, some dry cold cereal. So that part was such an adventure, like feeling like, oh, my God, I'm on my own. That felt like tremendous. And I like the people in this. I call it a boarding house, but it was really just a beautiful suburban home with some extra rooms where Tina and her husband Jim needed to help with the mortgage. And she was wonderful. She made us dinner 5 nights a week, and like I said, I played in the pool with their little boy, and it was. But I had no friends my own age. You know, I just sort of was very isolated there.
You said that your friend no longer participated in the Mormon Church, but brought you there. Did that seem strange? If he was no longer a member, but he thought it would be good for you?
No, because. You know, when you're 17, at least for me, you know, everything, like, you're willing to, like, oh, what's try it out. You know, I wasn't afraid. I kind of like just embracing like life. I always figured just throw yourself into every experience. You know, you'll live through it. But I really liked having experiences, and I tried not to be afraid. And he and I got along great. He was a 30-year-old radar technician who was on disability, so he had time. And he sort of became like a guardian to me. He could see, obviously, he was a 17-year-old kid who needed some guidance. So he wasn't active, but in the Mormon Church he used to be. But he thought, you know what, for me, for my sake, he said, listen, come to this little get-together on Monday nights. You know, you sing a song, you read a little scripture, you meet people, blah, blah, blah. And it's called Family Home Evening. And the Mormons, they do that usually on Monday nights. We have one night for the family to, you know, be together, have a moment of reflection, of sharing, you know, kind of like take time out of your life to really be together. So I went, and I felt like I was part of a family.
The Mormons are known to be the most charitable of any U.S. Religion, even when one discounts the tithing. Did you feel a warmth and interest in others that you hadn't seen before?
Yeah, it was actually weird. It was like I looked at them, and there was like a little bit of like a glow. And, you know, that sounds ridiculous, John. I mean, nobody glows. But, you know, that's a word that we sometimes use to describe people. And most of the guys I hung out in Jersey before I left home, you know, we'd sit in the car, get high in the morning, smoke weed in the parking lot. We were all miserable, unhappy with our families, and just couldn't wait to get out. And you know, it was just the usual teenage baloney, you know, mad at the world, everything is awful, you know. You know. So here I was.
Speaking of the marijuana, you said that you had decided once you got to the coast to stop any drug use. What brought that on?
I was always like a bit of a seeker, like, you know, those questions that we're all so bored with, like, you know, why am I here? Where am I going? What's my purpose? That bothered me so strongly. Like when I was a kid, I remember standing on the front lawn when I was 9 at our new house in Jersey, you know, where my stepfather had brought us. And I felt those, what am I doing here in this situation? And then the next question was, what am I doing here in this life? And you know, so those became the driving force in life that shaped my personality. I kind of never gave up on looking for those answers. So I'm getting a little distracted. What was your question again?
You said that as you just talked about smoking dope and everything in New Jersey, and you know, to me,
right.
You said you have decided to once you got to the coast that was over. What brought on that that change, that decision?
Right. Well, you just helped me remember where I was going. So with that, like always, like seeking, you know, first it was like with my friends, oh, maybe getting high will bring me closer to whatever. And, you know, it never did. So when I was out in California, I had no place to get marijuana. I didn't know anybody. And I thought to myself, it just occurred to me like an epiphany, like, why do I do this? What? I don't need to do this. It didn't do anything for me. And I said, why don't I take a big step and just keep looking for truth, you know, like if without, you know, without drugs. I don't, that didn't do anything for me. That was just like a something that I I thought might help me, but then it just became like a habit, a behavior. I thought, I want to change my behavior. I also stopped smoking cigarettes. I was like, why am I smoking cigarettes? You know, so I was really looking for to get on a good path somehow, you know, because I got out of my stepfather's shadow, and I thought, I want to live a good life that's, like, meaningful, and I want to have purpose. So why smoke cigarettes? Why smoke marijuana? That doesn't seem to be pushing me in the right way. So it's just like a decision to stop.
Okay. Had you belonged to an organized religion growing up or before you joined the Mormon Church?
Yeah. I grew up a Reform Jew and, you know, had my bar mitzvah. And I remember asking the rabbi those questions that were bothering me. You know, why are we here? You know, what's our purpose? And he was an elderly man, and he said, the Jewish religion is a rich religion with so much heritage and meaning and depth, and you should study, and you'll find your answers, you know, in that study. And I don't know, it was the right answer, but it didn't land with me. I just kind of thought, oh, thanks a lot. And it's just kind of, I want you to, like, tell me, like, give me some plain vanilla guidance, like, right now, why am I here? You know, don't tell me I have to go to a book and study and, you know, maybe someday I'll know. Like, tell me something now, I'm reaching out. So I didn't feel like, you know, I got any kind of answer. So
I just participated in a Holocaust remembrance at the Yorktown Town Board, I guess 2 weeks ago. And I wanted to write the poem about it. And it's so hard to put a handle on what a Jew is. I mean, to Adolf Hitler, a Jew was a religious Jew, was an atheist Jew, was a Polish Jew, it was a Middle Eastern Jew, was anything, just anything that he could label as a Jew. So you're right, there is, you know, is it a religion, is it a race, is it a culture? And whatever it is, it was enough to get all these people killed, you know. And I can understand people not wanting to pin down a definition now, because there is so much difference. Yeah, it's not like saying I'm Irish or I'm a Roman Catholic or whatever, you know. It's many things. So
well, you're talking about, like, the terrible history of, you know, and great unimaginable suffering of a people, and I'm sort of more like, I just wanted him to tell me, like, here's a path for you in your life, you know.
I understand. Tell us about your life in the Mormon Church.
You know, after I went to those, like, Monday night meetings, you know, the missionaries, there's always, like, two men and women, but it happened to be two guys, and they're both my age. They were, like, a year older, like 18 or 19, and they were there because, you know, they're lonely. They're on a mission. They're away from their families, and they started talking to me, and talk about, like, you know, glowing. These guys were, I couldn't believe it. It was like, I'm a 17-year-old kid. I'm looking at this other kid who's a little older than me. He's basically my age, though, maybe. And they're confident. They're wearing a suit and a tie, which I couldn't stomach. But they were so, like, sweet and just, I don't know, just filled with goodness. It just, and I was trying, John, to actually comprehend what I was looking at. I was like, I don't know anybody my age who has this presence. And that's what really got me more than anything. Forget about the words and the talk and the doctrine. It was like, they have something. I don't know what the hell it is, but these guys, they have something. And it's, and I can almost feel it. So that's kind of what got me drew me in.
These might have been some of the first people that you had met. At your age, it would have been some of the first people that I perhaps met, who not only had strong beliefs, they were willing to walk the walk. It was one thing to hear people preaching about you should be Christ-like, or you should follow the Torah, or you should do whatever, and you don't know to exactly what their life is, and these people are telling you at almost your age, this is what I believe, and I'm on my way. That must have been very impressive.
Yeah, it was. I think somehow inside I recognized this kind of looks like a path. Like they're on it. They're walking it. They're talking the talk. They're walking the walk. They're not home driving their cars around Friday nights on dates. They're like, you know, spreading, you know, the word of, you know, their religion. But just their presence was wonderful. And it really touched me. I have to at least be open, at a minimum, be open to this. So anyway, I just want to tell you one quick point. When I used to walk to high school as a kid, I used to think, you know, how does this all work, you know, this world? And I just kind of made up this little story, really short. You are in a field with a river running through it, and there's a house on the other side. And you know what you have to do. You got to cross this river and go into the house and do something. And so you go in the river, and as you're crossing, your memory's erased. And you get to the other side, and you see this house, and you don't know what it is, and you don't know what you have to do. But you're there, and you just feel moved to continue living, so you go into the house and somehow begin your life. And the missionaries that I met told me the Mormon doctrine, part of it was, we lived in a pre-existence. We saw God. We knew he was God. It was like, hey, God, what's happening? Hey, good, Jeff. I'm doing good here. And we come to earth to get a body, have experience, you know, pain, suffering, joy, love. You know, if without a body, it's kind of hard as a spirit to, like, know what suffering is. Like, I have a cough right now. I wouldn't know what that is as a spirit. So as spirit children, or spirit beings, or spirit whatevers, you know, Mormons say, we couldn't become like God. God knows everything. You got to have a body, dude. You got to get into life. You got to, you know, and then after you live a life, you're a little closer to being God. You know what suffering is. You know what joy is. You know what heartbreak is, you know, because you had a body. You had a physical existence. So anyway, long story short, when we came to Earth, our memory was erased, and then we start living our life. And that kind of, like, totally jived with my own personal little story. You know, you're in the field, there's a river, you cross the river, and I thought, your memory's erased, you're on the other side, you walk into this house and start living. So something like was like a aha, this we're on the same wavelength, so that kind of pulled me in.
Now, I know that you went on the mission, so I assume that you joined the church first, and you actually had to learn the foreign language before you go someplace. Have you ever had an experience like that before, and your toes held to learn something like that?
No, I was just like, you know, a B+ student. I was never very studious in high school, and here we were in the Mission Training Center, which is nuts. I mean, like, I had long hair, you know, down to my shoulders, you know, just I lived in jeans and a T-shirt, you know. And when I decided to go on a mission, I had to cut my hair off. I had to wear a suit and a tie. And then show up in this Mission Training Center, and you walk in the door, and there's, like, thousands of missionaries all in suits and ties, your age, walking around with a book in front of their face, you know, mumbling in some foreign language. So I felt like I wasn't even me. Like, where's Jeff? You know, I lost my identity. Like, I look at myself in a mirror and I go, this isn't me. And, you know, I'd left my girlfriend. She was a Mormon. But still, it was so painful just to lose your identity to become a missionary. I mean, you do, you know. I don't have, like, I used to have a motorcycle. You know, that's my thing. I get on my bike, do stuff. Now I'm walking around in a suit. It's like, this is not me. But I sort of made this commitment, like, to be on this path, to try to, you know, find a purpose. And it seemed like good. So I went there. I learned German in 2 months. They kind of, you just live it every day. You know, you try to speak it. Teachers are teaching it to you all day long. And when you get over to wherever you're going, I ended up in Austria when I started out. They put you with a guy who's already been there for a while, so he knows it backwards and forwards. He's, you know, fully fluent. And right away, you start picking that up the language, like, you know, really quick. So
it worked. And were you comfortable then being a missionary over there? Did you? Was it what you were looking for? Did it expand you, and did you learn a lot?
Yes and no. First of all, I wasn't comfortable. It was scary as all hell because you walk up to some door. But I hate doing this. Like, you know, can you imagine, John, you walk up to some door, hey, let me tell you about what I believe. And somebody goes, yeah, thanks a lot, bud. I'm fine, you know. And Germany's like, you know, the Northeast or most cities in America. They're like, it's a developed country. People are busy, you know, they're working. They got things on their mind. They're trying to get ahead. And there's two, like, goofy kids with suits and a name tag at their front door going, hey, we want to change your life. Stop what you're doing. So, believe it or not, I think it's just because we were so young, people were really nice to us. But it was really hard, you know, because it was frightening. You walk up to a door, you knock. And for the first little while, the older guy who you're with, you know, you always work in twos, he'll do the talking. But after a while, he'd look at you and go, hey, your turn. So the door opens, and there's some woman, really busy, you know, maybe with a baby on her arm, and I'm like, hi, you know, I'm Elder Edric, and, you know, I'm from the Mormon Church, and I'd like to share, you know, something I think is special and important to me, and would probably be to you too, if you could give me a moment. And they were always very sweet. We almost never had a bad experience, but, you know, most people were too busy and just said no thanks. So,
but I always took the book and everything. And the only funny thing, my brother was an Irish Christian brother in a Catholic church, so he was home one Sunday when I was young. So the doorbell rings, and it was right after the Kennedy assassination. I opened the door, and this. Two people are there in this time of tribulation. So I said, wait a minute, I'll be right back. I went in and told my brother, it's for you. so he went out, so he wound up coming back in with the Book of Mormon and that. You know, you're always respectful. How long were you there?
2 years, or 22 months, you know, 2 months in the Mission Training Center and 22 months out in the field. And it was 6 months in Austria and the rest of the time in Germany. Yeah, it was Munich and then a bunch of little towns, Coburg, Kempten. I forgot the others. Let me see. Anyway, but it was great.
And then what happened in your life when it was over?
Well, you know, I was... know, my stepfather kind of looked at my brother and myself as like excess baggage. So, you know, he never guided us and said, you know, you guys are going to go to college. You know, here's my vision for you, or ask me. Or my mom never said, you know, what do you want to be? Or, you know, even my real father was very good to us, but he never said college once. So I just thought, I don't know. And all the guys I was partnered with on the mission, they were like, yeah, so you're going to BYU after this? Like, just as a given. Brigham Young University at the Mormon College out in Provo, Utah. And I was like, no. You know, so after hearing it for the thousandth time, you know, it was like that little epiphany thing. It was like, why can't I go to college? Can't I? You know, it's just, it was so fixed in my mind that I started thinking, well, everybody else is going. Maybe this is part of my path. You know, be open to it. And I was writing letters back home. We weren't allowed to talk on the phone. They were afraid we'd get too like homesick or talk to our girlfriends, and you know, they really wanted us to be, you know, thinking about our mission, God, and you know, all that religious stuff. So I wrote my dad, and he said, oh my God, I never knew you were interested. Let's see what we can do. And he helped me get me into Brigham Young. So I got in.
So where'd you major in?
What?
What did you major in?
What's that?
The BYU. Huh?
Oh, film and television production.
And did you stay with it? Did you graduate?
Yeah. It became my career and had an amazing career just working for the TV networks like 60 Minutes and 2020 and Dateline and, you know, lots of probably 20% of the famous people on TV have clipped the microphone on at one point for an interview, you know, held a boom pole. Like one of my best memories is we were doing a thing for 60 Minutes with Bruce Springsteen, and I'm standing in his dressing room with him and the camera man, Kevin, and he says, hey guys, because he allowed us, he said, okay, yeah, you can get some shots of me rehearsing. And he says, hey, that, you know, that song Philadelphia, he says, I'm thinking about doing it on the guitar, you know, instead of the piano. He goes, what do you think of this? And he starts playing it, and it's a small room. Kevin's filming him. I'm holding the boom over his guitar and while he's singing. And that moment, I'm like, I cannot believe I am here. It was so incredible. It's just like, there's, you know, Springsteen treating us like, you know, we've always been his best friend. It was so amazing. So
we saw him years ago at a Madison Square Garden, and this guy had so much energy, and we were in a temporary thing behind the stage, and the whole thing was shaking. I thought the thing was going to come down. He was supposed to be on from 8 to 11, and he didn't come out until like 25 after 8, and I said, you know, he's going to have to be off before midnight because these guys get extra pay anyhow if it's a new day, and they're not going to let him stay out there. So he was he played for about two hours, took a break, came back, and played till 20 after 1. It was incredible. And the
wow, the
electricity in the place, you know.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
But before you came back,
you know,
to New York, you worked out there, and you wound up getting married out there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. When I was at school, and this is, you know, the Mormon thing again, they really want you to start your family and, you know, just get going with a good life, you know. Of course, everybody wants that. That's not exclusive to anyone, but they push it really hard. Like, you know, when we'd go to church in the cafeteria at the Brigham Young University. And, you know, the guys talking would always say, now, you know, it's important you find a mate and important you start your family and you live, you know, a righteous life and la la. And, you know, there was a bit of guilt, like if by your sophomore or your junior year, you kind of hadn't found somebody that you were probably going to marry. You know, if you were single and older at BYU, it was like, there's something you're doing wrong there, bud. You know, it was really, I mean, nobody like beat you up about it, but it was always like, here's what you want to do to have a good life. Are you guys listening? La, la, la. So in my sophomore year, you know, I met my wife, somebody I got along with. We liked each other well enough. And kind of just said, you know, maybe we should get married. You know, when we both kind of felt like, yeah, yeah, we like each other. We get along. We can, we want to start. But it was a little bit of church pressure, you know. But we did. Then we had, oh, no, no. I was working in Utah. I got a job after I graduated in TV. But I just felt bored out of my mind out there. And I wrote my real father, and he said, come on, you guys, come over to New York. And we lived in his apartment with him for a month until we both found jobs in the city. And holy cow, I got a job in a production rental house, you know, renting TV equipment out to folks. And after a year and a half, I called up all the people I used to, you know, hand the cameras over to and said, hey, if I went freelance, would you hire me? And they all said yes, and they did. So I quit my job. I'm really thankful to my boss, Bob Zahn. He hired me. You know, I learned a lot working there. And because I worked there, I was skilled enough to go out as a freelancer. And at first I did some lightweight video engineering, and then I moved into sound after that. So began a career.
You told me once that while you made your living working in the TV field, that you had no interest in watching it. Why is that? And does that include news, sports, and documentaries, as well as commercial television?
Yeah, because when I, you know, believe it or not, I left out a big piece, John. After I came back to New York, you know, my wife and I got a house, you know, out in Westchester, and we didn't go to church anymore. We kind of stopped going, and I kind of just didn't need it anymore, you know. And I always felt this guilt of like, wow, God's looking down going, hey, Jeff, not good, bud, you know. You know, you went on a mission, the Mormons took you in, now you're not going to church. I'm not happy. I love you, but I'm not really pleased. And I felt that guilt, John, like for like 7 years. And I remember, and this is really important for me to say, one day I was outside in my yard and I realized I don't feel guilty anymore. I don't care that I'm not going to church. If God loves me, yeah, He loves me whether I'm going or not. And he also wants me. And you know what? Now I don't even believe in that. But at that moment, I realized I don't feel guilty anymore. And that was such a weight off my shoulders. It was a huge weight off my shoulders.
You felt liberated.
Totally liberated.
Let me take you back to the television question now. Since you made all your money working in the field, when you said you had no interest in watching it, and does it include news, sports, and documentary as well as commercial television? Is it just all television? Doesn't interest you as a consumer?
Right. It doesn't. Because, and this, you know, sounds like I'm some snotty ass, arrogant, you know, guy who's just full of baloney, but it, you know, I feel like the authenticity of life is in is not in watching other people's experiences on TV for entertainment or documentaries. I just feel like I want to live my experience in this life. And if I spend an hour or 2 hours watching somebody else, you know, with their experience, it's like that's an hour or two I could have been reading, writing, walking, kayaking, you know, talking with a human being. And today's society, and here's what I was going to get into a little bit, is like, you know, we all want to fit in with the cultural tribe of life. You know, we don't want to be on the outs. You don't want to walk down the street or get in your car and, you know, be a an outsider. You kind of want to fit in with the world where you live. But the world where I live on TV just tends to make my head go dead. So I kind of actively decided I don't need to look at a television set to find any support or enlightenment, or I just need to look within myself and live my life. So it was kind of a decision like that.
But might not seeing the misery of these kids at the border, for instance, become fodder for your own writing that might not have been there if you hadn't seen it, if you just heard about it or read about it in the newspaper?
No, you're absolutely right. You're right. I just mean generally. I mean, of course, I've heard of that. I mean, anything that's terrible going on in the world, I hear about it. You know, I listen to my radio in the car in the morning. The TV's on somewhere. I see it, and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I'll sit and watch. But just generally, like, I don't make a point of watching television. I lived in a place I'm living now with my partner, Amy, in her home, and we have a television, and I watch with her, you know, as like, you know, because we care about each other and we want to share some things together. But before that, when I was on my own, I didn't even own a TV, and I never felt the need to even have a connection to that. But I agree with you, John. The important news about the suffering of other people, that's, you know, it's good to know in case you decide to act and try to change things and make them better. So, yeah.
Now, while you had this, what could also be the typical suburban family with the house and with the daughter and the wife, at some point you were on the go again, still searching. Did you know what you were searching for, really, or not?
You know, I didn't mention this to you, but I did want to just, like, not live anymore. I was unhappy in my marriage. You know, no, all of us were trying our best. My ex, you know, she was trying her best in her mind to be, you know, good, and I was trying to be good, but somehow it was just difficult. I was just so unhappy. I just became depressed and felt like my life was over. And so I just was hoping that, you know, a car would hit me, and so I wouldn't have to have the stigma of like, oh, you know, this guy killed himself. That's awful. How could he do that? I kept wishing, you know, I'd just be like out like for a jog and, you know, boop, gone. It's just, you know. So when you get to those depths of unhappiness, sometimes, not all the times, sometimes you're just a depressed, miserable person, but I felt like now I'm really looking for something in the deepest way possible, and I got into meditation, and that kind of really helped immensely. Just being still, just shutting up. If you shut up long enough, you open your eyes and you go, wow, this is beautiful. Just regular life. But you got to shut up long enough to have that wow happen. And, you know, I had to go through that depression, kind of pushed me.
That sounds like my friend Jim Casey with the silence that he's always looking for, you know. How did you get involved with writing?
I did this documentary about HIV and AIDS being disproportionately part of the African-American community. And I used to have a lot of emails back and forth with the producer who was very kind of saintly almost. You know, she's one of these people who, like the young missionaries that had a glow around them, she
right.
had this glow around her. And at some point, you know, with our conversations, she said to me, do you know you can write? Because, you know, I've been writing, expressing myself to her. And I felt kind of spurred on, and I started to write. And then people said they felt moved by it. And then I started to feel like, I wonder if this is what I was looking for. You know, something that had meaning for me in my life. And one day I was getting a haircut, and one of the ladies who cut the hair at this place was a member of the writers group. And she saw me with my laptop open and said, hey, you ought to show up, you know. So I came one night and read something, and I was just lucky. The group loved it, and I got such a warm feeling from the group. I felt accepted and kind of like, maybe this is a place for me. And then I started going all the time. Now I publish, self-published, three books. And I feel like I've found what I've been looking for my whole life. The beauty, just, you know, in this quiet meditation. And when I'm not doing that, after I'm done working to write, just makes me feel like I have a purpose.
For a few years, my teaching schedule interfered with my regular attendance at the group meetings. Now that I'm back full-time, your attendance seems more occasional. Is it something I said?
Oh, yeah, I've been meaning to talk to you about that, John. It's your choice of shirts. I think you need to, like, get, like, more, like, towards the blue. You know, you're wearing too much in the warm color category. You know, too many, like, russets and browns, you know. If you give me some of the, like, bright reds, or, and then I'll come back. So, I'm kidding.
I know. Tell us about your writing so far. You mentioned that you've had a few books published. And I know that you're, I'm going to ask you to read the poem in a moment, but have you concentrated totally on poetry, or have you been writing other things also?
Poetry and short stories. And the short stories are always end up being like fables. Like, one of the short stories is like a guy who's talking to the wind. He's actually dead. He doesn't know it. And he's in a graveyard. It's gorgeous. You know, goes on forever, these gravestones. And he's trying to figure out where is he, you know. And he hears the wind blowing, and he senses the presence in the wind, and then starts talking to the wind. And the way I wrote it is, you never hear words that the wind says. You just see two pairs of quotation marks with space in between. So the wind is just, like, silent. But based on what he says and his response, you know what the wind has told him. So that's like a little fable story. So I like to do stuff like that. I did another one called Michael, about a young boy who gets drafted and on the battlefield joins his dead brother in heaven and looks down and sees himself fighting and makes a choice to go back. I don't know why, John. I always like to write a little bit of a fairy tale-ish, you know, fable-y kind of story.
Dude just mentioned the brother. Did your brother follow any of your paths after he got old enough to make his own choices?
Yeah, this is crazy. He went into production and has a video production company. He's the boss, and he hires me.
Terrific.
You never saw that coming. I'm working for him tomorrow.
Would you read a poem? For us?
Yeah. I'm just going to do a little bit. I don't, because it's two pages. And just to give you a sense, it's called I'm Making This Fire for You. I am making this fire for you. If you could look through the many trees, you would see my hands gathering stones from the river and branches from the ground. If you could look through the hills and mountains, you would see my bones kneeling to the sun god, binding the lost arrows, planting seeds in the valley. If you could listen across the fields, you would hear my voice singing, my little leaf, my tree, my wings above the earth.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Why don't you finish it for us, Jeff?
Okay. The wind blows this day home, and the still mountain sleeps. The long black night leaves its stars in the shallows of the river. Breath moves my hands. I peel the thin branch, stripping its bark. It is soft and smooth underneath. I am close to the ground, drawing a line between here and the clouds, setting a mark to point to the fertile places. Ancestors pull at my skin and wash my hair gray. Come, they say. I am not ready. I laugh and dance until they smile and give me 20 moons more. I dance and they tell me where the second current of the river lies and where the hidden breeze of your soul has blown. And I find it on the top of a boulder where it is scooped out like a bowl, filled with water from the rain. In the still water, I can see your face looking to the sun. Looks to sun is your name. I drink the water and know what to do. I talk to the sun for days and nights, even when it is hiding, I am talking. And finally, the sun says, I cannot rest with you talking to me all the time. Even when I get into my bed below the mountain and cover my hot bones with night's cool stillness, you are keeping me awake. And the sun gives me a part of its burning light. And that is when it happens. Our children ask, if you found me in the sky or the river, I laugh when you tell the story of how I found you in the water, in the bowl of the boulder, of how it told me the secret of your name and how the wind of your spirit jumped into my heart.
Very nice. I like that.
Thank you.
In the not-so-distant past, your personal life became more settled and fulfilling. Am I right?
Yeah, you are right. I am very happy now. I'm settled with Amy. We live together in a beautiful house. It's her home. And I'm tasting for the first time like what it is to have like a life that's pretty tranquil and lovely.
Are you, what's next for you? Do you have another poetry book in progress, or are you submitting to various magazines? What are you doing?
I have another book in progress. You know, I like to do around 200 pages. I'm up to about 30 pages. I'm trying to just, you know, branch out a little more. All the stuff I write is always about this deep heart, very, like, heavy feeling sort of stuff. So I'm trying to do stuff that's still beautiful and touching and deep, but it's not so heavy. You know, stuff that's maybe got a little joy in there. So I'm working on that. And quite honestly, John, that's been my one failing, is not to be submitting on a regular basis. That's just, you just have to do that. If you want to be a poet, a writer, you have to submit, you know, get rejected.
And get rejected.
Submitting. Sorry?
And get rejected and submit again and get rejected. It's
yeah,
one of the interesting things we talk about at the poetry group.
It doesn't bother me at all because I feel I know my stuff is good. It's just, you know, at some point somebody will go, oh, this fits right now, and they'll take it. But I need to do that. That should
be a regular part. The important thing is to know where to send it. And there's so much out there. And very often people just send things to magazines that they've heard of. They don't realize that this magazine only publishes nature poetry or sports poetry or whatever. There is just so much going on. That's why this duotrope is terrific, because every week you get the new listings of what's out there. It tells you something about the magazine, and you can keep an inventory of what you've submitted. It's just well worth it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned
it's work.
It'll spur me to get on the horse and start doing that again.
Do you want to read something else?
Just you know, a quick one liner. Let's just see. I found a couple of things. Okay, here's called Ancient Call. Every morning the woodcarver comes. I know the word. He is carving on my heart.
Okay, I like that also.
Thank you.
The,
and here's... well, that... Okay, so that one, basically, it's like we all know, you know, we wake up every morning, and or when we're quiet, we kind of have a feeling that, you know, that's the woodcarver carving the word on your heart. So find out what that word is, you know. I got
that's
one other
it.
Short one.
No, go.
Okay, it's called Peeps. I will be forgotten. No one will remember. I used to think it would be sad to be forgotten. But now I think the sun is shining. Perhaps I will be the light on the water.
Perhaps you will be.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Jeff Edrich?
Just that our journeys are all pretty much the same. Just, you know, they're just painted a little differently. Kind of like Joseph Campbell said, we're all on a hero's journey, trying to find what's right as, you know, as we walk through our lives. And I guess what I want people to know is I'm feeling pretty close. Don't need to search anymore for, you know, a purpose. I love my writing, and the peace that I find in just being still, you know, with the meditation. Nothing formal. You just sit on a rock, and as long as I can be still for a little while, I open my eyes and I'm like, wow, look at this. And that's enough. And that's good enough for me. That's peace and a good life.
It's great that you found it. Jeff, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you, John. It's been great. You helped make me think of some things that are important and good for me to do. Yeah, thank you.
I hope the audience will all bring it back next week for my interview with Bob Lee. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. As I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And after tonight's thing, let's go off with the Eagles and Peaceful, Easy Feeling. Alexa, play Peaceful, Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful, Easy Feeling from your library.
Again, Jeff, and good night, everybody.